The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My fellow primates, welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman. I'm a producer and editor here in the Author Events office, and I'm very excited to be here tonight to introduce Adam Rutherford. Mr. Rutherford's books include 2017's A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, a daunting title if ever there was one, the ages-spanning story of our species told through the study of genomics, winner of the 2018 Thomas Bonner Book Prize, a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award, and a National Geographic Best Book of 2017. It tracks the recently unlocked secrets of the migration, disease, war, birth, and sex experienced by our ancient ancestors. In addition to the wonderful New York Times book review blurb you can see right in your program, it was also referred to by The Guardian as, quote, an effervescent work, brimming with tales and confounding ideas carried in the epic poem in our cells. A University College PhD, Mr. Rutherford has also written and hosted several programs for the BBC, including The Cell and Playing God, and is the presenter of the BBC Radio 4's premier science show, Inside Science. He is a frequent contributor to The Guardian. He's appeared in BBC Radio's The Infinite Monkey Cage, and a self-proclaimed movie geek. He has served as the science advisor for several films and television shows, including World War Z, Ex Machina, and The Cat in the Hat Knows a Lot About That. I'll be asking about two of those after tonight's talk. His new book is called Humanimal, How Homo Sapiens Became Nature's Most Paradoxical Creature, A New Evolutionary History. It asks the question, what does it mean to be human? Our genome is 98% identical to a chimp's. So are we as remarkable as we think we are? Are chimps even more extraordinary than we think they are? In King Lear, Shakespeare weighs in saying, thou art the thing itself. Unaccommodated man is no more than such a poor, bare, forked animal as thou art. And he ought to know. He was a very smart primate himself. Here to shed some light on just what it is that makes us human, animal, and truly exceptional, ladies, gentlemen, and humanimals of all ages, join me in welcoming Adam Rutherford to the Free Library.
Thank you, Jason. That's a very generous introduction. And thank you for inviting me to Philadelphia. It's my first time here. It's a real honor to be in such a prestigious space. As Jason said, this is a book about what it means to be human. In my last book, A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, I covered about a million years worth of human evolution. In this one, I'm limiting my scope to just, well, pretty much the last 100,000 years of human evolution. So, you know, I'm really focusing and narrowing it down. Subtitle there, How Homo Sapiens Became Nature's Most Paradoxical Creature, that is really crucial, the central thesis to the book, that we are both animals, we are evolved, we have the same DNA, the same proteins, the same cell structures as every organism that has ever existed, and yet at the same time we are capable of such wonders. So this question of human uniqueness is central. But in all of my work, I try to embrace the complexity and the reality of science and of evolution, and I try to steer myself away from singular narratives, from uniqueness theories. This is the thing that has triggered our modern human behavior. There are many things which we have historically thought of as being unique to humans, which turn out to be maybe different by degree or by kind or not different at all. And those are the sorts of areas I want to explore. A lot of people have made entire careers suggesting that there are individual things that are unique to us, like speech or control of fire or tool use, or recently a paper suggesting that our taking hallucinogenic drugs was absolutely a pivotal moment in our development from an earlier, less sophisticated ape into the one that we recognize today. The truth of the matter is that the thing that makes us human is having two human parents and having a human genome, but that is a terribly dull answer. And it doesn't really help us at all in answering questions about the human condition, how we got to be where we are. So this paradox that is inherent to the human condition, in a scientific sense, it was my intellectual hero, Charles Darwin, who first pointed this out in his second best book, The Descent of Man, in 1871, this beautiful quote. So Darwin was an outstanding writer, beautiful writer of the most wonderful prose, and also, of course, the founder of the best idea that anyone ever had. In The Descent of Man, he talks about this paradox. He says that we have godlike intellect. We can understand the solar system, the mechanisms of the solar system. We have these exalted powers. And yet, man, in 18th century language, still bears in our bodily frame the indelible stamp of our lowly origin. So there is the paradox. We are superior intellectual beings, and yet at the same time we carry this stamp of our evolution. A better writer than Darwin, and thank you, Jason, for quoting Shakespeare up top, said this 250 years earlier in the very famous, the wonderful soliloquy by Hamlet, where he says, "What a piece of work is a man, how noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in action how like an angel, in apprehension how like a god." This line, the line that comes next, "the paragon of animals." So this is such a wonderful, evocative phrase, so much so that I wanted to call the book "The Paragon of Animals," but my editor told me that was really pretentious. Just after this line, Hamlet goes on to say, "But what is this quintessence of dust?" Expressing exactly the same idea as Darwin, that we are wonderful, we are the paragon of animals, and yet at the same time we are merely made of matter. Now, as Jason in the introduction very kindly alluded to, I do work in films and I'm a film obsessive. And there was a third line that I actually wrote in the final chapter in the last book, A Brief History of Everyone Who Ever Lived, because I was expressing a slightly different idea, but it was so perfect that it was in fact a trigger for writing this book. And the line was, "Everyone is special," which is another way of saying that no one is. And I wrote this and realized, well, I didn't realize. In fact, it was my editor who thanked me for putting another movie quote in, and I didn't realize what it was. Does anybody know what this film is from? It's from The Incredibles, yes. So in the first three pages of this book, I quote Darwin, Hamlet, and Dash from The Incredibles. So I'm proud of that. Now, human evolution, the study of how we got to be here, has radically transformed in the last 10 years, even more so in the last 5 years. And the primary reason for that is the introduction of a new source material, a new piece of evidence in studying old bones, and that is DNA. So in the last few years, since about 2008 or 9, we began to invent the technology to actually get DNA out of bones that have been in the ground for tens of thousands or even hundreds of thousands of years. And with our increased understanding of how the code of DNA relates to the phenotype, the way we are, the physical presence of our lives, we began to extract tons more information about our evolutionary cousins and antecedents. And so that entire picture of human evolution has radically transformed. It's been a revolution. It's an ongoing revolution, and it's quite hard to keep up. But let me give you a quick recap of the last million years. So this is a tree of life, a standard tree of life as we draw in evolutionary biology. On the side nearest to me, it's a million years ago, so a root to the tree of the branch that is the humans. And on the far side, it is the present. And at the bottom, we've got Homo sapiens, that's us, divided into three groups, Asians, Europeans, and Africans. Now, there was an earlier type of Homo sapiens, so the same species as us, that migrated out of Africa more than 100,000 years ago and made it all the way into Eurasia, but doesn't leave any living descendants today. So that was a terminal branch. Now, you all know about the Neanderthals. So the Neanderthals, primarily a European species, but actually Eurasian. So the more we look, the more we find Neanderthals into Asia. And we divide the Neanderthals into Western and Eastern. Now, we sequenced the Neanderthal genome in 2009, so we got a full genome from a species of human that had been extinct for about 40,000 years. And then you might recall in about 2010, there was the discovery of a single finger bone, the distal tip of the little finger of a teenage girl, so just this bone at the end of your pinky. And a single tooth in a cave in Siberia, the cave called Denisova, named after an 18th century Russian eremite called Denis. And those physical remains are not enough to characterize an entire species. So there's just not enough physical material to say this is what species this girl was. But researchers managed to get the entire genome out of the finger bone, and we could tell by comparing it to the Neanderthal genome and the Homo sapiens, our extant living genome, that it was significantly different enough that it could be classified as a human, but different to Neanderthals and different to us. And we call those people the Denisovans. Now, this is an evolutionary tree, and these are the types of trees that we were brought up thinking about, standard issue in evolutionary biology. The first one drawn by Charles Darwin in 1837. So this is one of the sort of hallmarks of evolutionary theory. However, genetics has shown that this metaphor, the tree, well, it doesn't really work that well in many cases, and it doesn't really work that well for humans. And the reason we know it doesn't work very well for humans is because of genetics. So genetics is effectively the study of inheritance and families and sex. And we talk about, there's a euphemistic term which is called a gene flow event. Right? A gene flow event is the flow of genes from one creature to another. Yeah, it means sex. And because of genomes, because of being able to get DNA out of these three types of humans, the Denisovans, Neanderthals, and Homo sapiens, we actually began to discover in 2009, 2010, that there are gene flow events between all of these. And so what the map actually looks like, it has dotted lines. These trees have dotted lines between the branches that we used to think were distinct. So for example, we know that the Western Neanderthals had gene flow events with the people who emerged from Africa who would become Asians and Europeans. We also know that the Western Neanderthals had gene flow events. They interbred with Europeans. And just glancing around the room, most of you are from, well, in this light, look like you have recent European ancestry. The evidence for that is that you carry something like 1 to 1.5% Neanderthal DNA. The further east you go, the more you find that Neanderthal DNA is replaced by Denisovan DNA. So East Asians have a percentage of Denisovan DNA, where Europeans tend to have Neanderthal DNA. So that's another gene flow event between the Neanderthals and the archaic modern humans. Both archaic modern Homo sapiens and the Eastern Neanderthals, they're both now extinct, but we can tell that from the bones, from the DNA taken out of the bones. And I just mentioned that the Denisovans interacted, they had gene flow events between the Eastern Neanderthals. So I don't know what the right metaphor for this is, but it's not a tree. It's a sort of tangled thicket, a tangled bank, maybe, which is a very Darwinian phrase. But it's definitely not a tree, because all of these branches of species that we thought were distinct and separate actually interbred successfully with almost all other types of humans. And I guarantee you this picture is going to get more complicated within the next year, and definitely more complicated in the next few years. Now, you might have noticed that I haven't mentioned the top branch on this tree, because it's a piece of science which is, it's so awesome, I think it's close to, it's indistinguishable from magic almost, which is that when we compare the genomes of Homo sapiens with Neanderthals, with the Denisovans appear to have a bit of DNA which doesn't correspond to either of the other two. And so from that, we can legitimately infer that there was another species that we don't have any physical remains for. We call this a mystery human or a phantom species. We know that this mystery human interacted, had gene flow events with the Denisovans, because the Denisovans carry that genetic information. We may know what species that is. We may have those bones, but we've never got DNA out of them. So until we get DNA out of those bones, it remains a phantom species. So there is the picture of the last million years of human evolution as we now know it, as a result of genetics. This picture will change. It will get more complicated as we continue to look. Now, one aspect of this paradox, the conundrum of human evolution, is exemplified by what is now the oldest Homo sapiens specimen that we're aware of, which doesn't come from the Rift Valley in East Africa, which is where we typically think of as the cradle of Homo sapiens, but actually from Morocco, a place called Jebel Irud. And this image here is the skull from Jebel Irud that was dated a couple of years ago as being 300,000 years old, a minimum of 300,000 years old. So that puts the location of the earliest Homo sapiens away from East Africa into North Africa, and it pushes back the date by another 100,000 years. Now, the point about this is that if you were to take one of the Jebel Irud specimens, and we met them for real, and they were alive, and we tidied them up and shaved them or put them in some nice clothes, put them in a suit or a dress, then you wouldn't be able to tell the difference between them and us if they were sitting next to you in this room or on the subway. Physically, we haven't significantly changed in more than 250,000 years. That also applies genetically as well. There are plenty of genetic changes that we can track and that we can measure as we adapted to local environments, as we spread around the world. But the truth is they're not so significant that we wouldn't be able to interbreed with any human, or any Homo sapiens for the last 250,000 years. So anatomically, physiologically, genetically, we haven't significantly changed in 250,000 years. We have spread all over the world, but we remain the same species. And yet, something really significant did change within the last 100,000 years, but more specifically, the last 40,000 years. And that's exemplified by the presence and the discovery of artifacts from our cultural history, such as this amazing specimen, which was discovered in the 1930s in a cave in Germany. And it's referred to as the Löwenmensch of Hohenstein-Stadel. It's a lion man. It is a 12-inch statue carved out of a tusk. And it is a man. It has 7 stripes down the left arm, which may be representative of tattoos. We know that tattooing was a thing at that time in Homo sapiens and in Neanderthals. But it has a lion's head, a cave lion's head. So it's an imagined being. It's a creation of a mind which is not dissimilar to our own. It requires a great deal of skill, a great deal of foresight. It wouldn't have existed in isolation. It would be a part of a series, which we will probably never find. But the amount of planning, the amount of skill, the amount of imagination, the amount of abstract thought that has gone into this indicates that whoever the artist who created this amazing statue had a mind that was no different from ours today. We don't see evidence of this type of abstraction of thoughts earlier than 40,000 years ago, which is the date of the Lion Man. Within a few thousand years of that, we see a series of other little statuettes, figurines. They're called Venus figurines. They all tend to be, they're all females. They're smaller. This one I'm showing here is the oldest. It's called the Venus of Holy Fels. It's about 38,000 years old, also found in southern Germany. And they are often thought of, written about as being fertility amulets or reproductive charms. They often have exaggerated sexual characteristics. But the truth of the matter is we have no idea what they were for. That is speculation. It's difficult enough to know the mind of someone sitting opposite you today, let alone the mind of someone who died 40,000 years ago. We don't know what their motivation was. They may have been toys. They might have been dolls. They might have been fertility amulets. They might have been pornography. That is not my suggestion. That is in the academic literature. But again, the point is that the minds behind these creations, these figurative depictions of human beings, were no different from our own today. Again, they take foresight, abstraction, artistic skill, all sorts of aspects of behavioral modernity, as we sometimes call it, which are no different from us today. Within a few thousand years of that, we have cave paintings that you'll all be aware of, things like this beautiful image of the Megaloceros in Lascaux in the southwest of France, and cave paintings all around Europe. Europe is the place that we've studied the most, but that Eurocentrism is fading as we keep looking all over the rest of the world. A couple of years ago, these cave paintings from Sulawesi in Indonesia were dated as being 35 to 38,000 years old. They're actually hand stencils, so they're hollow tubes, probably bones, with red ochre blown through them to create stencils. And we see this type of art all over the world within a few thousand years of Sulawesi in Indonesia. So we've moved away from Europe, but I said that the Lion Man was the oldest piece of figurative art that we were aware of. Well, that was true until last year, when this cave painting in a cave in Borneo, a huge cathedral-like space, not dissimilar to the room that we're in. This is a painting of a banteng, which is an indigenous cow. And it's huge. It's like, you know, several feet across on the ceiling. And this was redated in a paper published just in autumn last year. This is an indication of how quickly this field is moving, much to the chagrin of my editors, where I constantly change things after deadlines have passed. But the date of this banteng in Borneo is a minimum of 40,000 years. So it's the same sort of age range as the Lion Man of Hohenstein-Stadel, but it's a minimum, so it's probably a bit older than that. And what this shows is that these ideas of behavioral modernity, these ideas of abstract thought process of minds similar to our own, is not just happening in Europe. It doesn't have a single focal point. It actually is occurring all around the world at approximately the same time. Everything I've shown you so far has been Homo sapiens. Now, that changed in 2018 when some cave paintings in Cantabria, which is on the northern coast of Spain, discovered in the 60s but were redated in February last year. And they're a depiction, a very abstract depiction, paintings on a wall, again red ochre, of the back end of a bovid, some sort of cow, we can't really tell, the front end of a cow, and an abstract sort of figure. This is an enhanced image because it's quite faded on the stone itself. But this was dated as being a minimum of 60,000 years old. Now, the only people in Spain 60,000 years ago were not us. They were Homo neanderthalensis, the Neanderthals. And this is part of a revision of what Neanderthals were, because we tend to historically think of Neanderthals as being, well, cave people, you know, thuggish, grunting oafs. And it's just not true. Part of that legend is because one specimen found in the 1920s actually had osteoporosis, but we didn't discover it had osteoporosis until the 1980s. And so it was hunched over, but that's because it was a very old, diseased man, and that we thought that that was typical for Neanderthals, when in fact it was incredibly atypical. But Neanderthals were cultured humans. They had complex culture, complex art, abstract thought, if this dating is correct. They probably revered their dead, and they did look a bit different from us. They had heavier brows than us, barrel chests, much more muscly than Homo sapiens, but not so different that your ancestors didn't have sex with them. Now, when we're thinking about art and the creation of these types of cultural artifacts, these indications of minds similar to our own, we have to think about one of the things, one of the two or three things that Charles Darwin identified as possibly being unique to Homo sapiens, unique to us. And I go through all of these in the book in great detail, but I'll just focus on a couple here. Now, Darwin thought that we were possibly unique in our use of tools. We are obligate tool users, meaning that we cannot exist without extending our physical capabilities by manipulating the environment in front of us. In the 1960s, the Leakey family, working out in Olduvai Gorge in the Rift Valley, discovered an early, the earliest known examples of tools associated with Homo sapiens, and they're known as the Olduwan chopper, or the Olduwan tool set. The first ones found were made from obsidian, which is a volcanic igneous glass, chipped away to create sharp edges. And they were discovered, these tools, these napped stones, were discovered alongside human remains of a species which is the earliest known member of the genus Homo, therefore the humans, and it was named Homo habilis. And Homo habilis literally translates from the Latin as handyman. So the fact that we were finding tools associated with this new species of human, and we defined this new species of human, the earliest species of human known, as tool users, is indicative of how long we have been obligate tool users, how long we've been associated with extending our range with tools, with technology. We are a technological species. That was the 1960s. As ever, science progresses the more we look. And in fact, in the 1990s, an earlier species, not in the genus Homo, but in a new category called Kenyanthropus platyops, was discovered in the same place in Olduvai Gorge, but dates to more than 3 million years old, and was also found with the Olduwan tool set in the same lithic layers, meaning that we have been obligate tool users for at least 3 million years, a million years longer than we've been in the family human, and you know, more than 2.7 million years longer than we've been Homo sapiens. So we've been tool users for a very long time. The Olduwan tool set is stable through time for more than 1.5 million years. And then we see it all over the world. We see it from Europe, Africa, all over East Asia, right down into Australia as humans spread. We don't see it on the American continents, because humans didn't really reach there until about 20,000 years ago. But the Olduwan chopper is replaced by a slightly more sophisticated set of tools, which are referred to as the Acheulean tool set. And they tend to be bigger and more versatile, sharper edges, different types of tools. Now, what these don't, these are lithic, so they're stones, they're the things that remain. What these don't show, these tools, is what these tools were used to create other tools, made out of biodegradable materials like wood and animal products. But these are the ones that remain. And indeed, we name our geological eras after stone: Neolithic, New Stone, Mesolithic, Middle Age Stone, Paleolithic, Old Stone. So the question is, right, we are obligate tool users, we've been obligate tool users for 3 million years. Was Darwin right? Are we the only organism to use tools in this manner? Well, you know the answer to this, because for years, people like Jane Goodall and Franz de Waal have been studying tool use in primates, and we see amazing films by David Attenborough and others, in which we see things like orangutan spear fishing. And all the primates use wooden tools to some degree in many forms. You probably are aware that more and more we're studying corvids, particularly the Caledonian crows, who are also obligate tool users and very skillful. Not only do they use tools for particular tasks, they create tools by bending them so they have hooks rather than straight spikes. A hook is better than a spike if you're catching a fat grub. We also know that the corvids use one tool to get another tool. If you put in an experiment a good-looking tool out of reach through bars, they will use a less good tool to actually pull the good one through, and then they'll go and use it. So primates use it, we use it, lots of mammals use tools, or obligate tool users. What's really interesting is that 1% of animals turn out to be obligate tool users, and that ranges across all classes of animals, 9 classes of animals, including mammals, primates, but also mollusks. So the octopus uses tools. My own personal favorite is the crustacean. This is a boxer crab. It used to be called a boxer crab. There's several species of these, and what they do is they pick up stinging anemones in their pincers, and they use them to fight with other crabs and ward off enemies. They don't get called boxer crabs anymore, because the action itself is much more reminiscent of being a cheerleader. So they actually get called pom-pom crabs instead, which I'm sure is not their intention. But do have a look at those videos on YouTube, because they're hilarious. So we see tool use across tons and tons of different animals that range, that are very distantly related. And it indicates that being a tool user hasn't had a central origin from which all other subsequent tool users have been descended. It's clearly a useful trick, which is something that Daniel Dennett describes as a good trick. So, you know, extending your range through the physical manipulation of your environment is a good thing to do. What is different about humans is that we tend to craft our tools and the extension of our physical forms through cultural accumulation, is the technical term, but basically we are not reliant on passing down information from one generation to the next, or to people that we are very directly related to. We are effectively, and this is the way I'm characterizing in the book, we are a species of teacher. Many animals learn, but only humans teach, for the most part. Biology is a science of exceptions, and there are a couple of exceptions. But this idea of cultural transmission is really central to the book, and I'll come on to why towards the end. But before that, I just want to talk about a couple of examples of cultural transmissions, the very, very few examples of cultural transmission of tool use in other animals. And the first is the dolphins of Shark Bay. So these are bottlenose dolphins. They've been studied since the 1970s, 1980s. And a few years ago, in the 1980s, it was observed that some of these dolphins in Shark Bay, it's a big pod, it's a big, big family, extended family in a large area of ocean, were observed doing something slightly odd, which is they were swimming down to the bottom, finding conical-shaped sponges, and working the sponges onto their rostra, which is their beak, or their nose, if you like, and holding them on their nose and then swimming off. And further study, so divers found out that the reason they were doing this is because they're using the sponges to protect their noses when they're foraging at the bottom of the ocean, where they're protecting from getting scratched up by rocks when they're actually trying to eat things like boxer crabs or pom-pom crabs. And that is really, I mean, that is a fascinatingly cool thing. In terms of a behavior, that is just magnificent. It became more interesting in the 1990s and into the 2000s when they were studied more closely, because something very unusual about the sponging dolphins was discovered, which is that the only members of the bottlenose dolphin species in Shark Bay that do this behavior are female. So no male has ever been observed doing this behavior. We don't know why that is. There doesn't appear to be any reproductive differential success between the males and the females, but there's never been a male dolphin observed doing this highly sensible behavior. So you can draw your own conclusions about that. But then further into in 2015-16, researchers down in Shark Bay start to take genetic samples from the sponging dolphins. And from that, we can get two really interesting pieces of information. The first is that the females doing the sponging behavior are not particularly closely related. So we think this is an example of cultural transmission. These are dolphins learning this behavior off their not just sisters, but female cousins, female relatives, never from the male relatives. So it's one of the few examples of cultural transmission outside of humans in another mammal in this case. But the other thing, which is really, I just love this, is that by looking at the spread of the genetic, the genetics of the individuals doing sponging behavior, we can also track back through evolutionary time. We know the generational time of bottlenose dolphins is about 25 years. And the pattern of who was doing this behavior meant that we could isolate, it turned out, an individual, a female dolphin, originated this behavior in the middle of the 19th century. So one morning, a female dolphin got up. Do they get up? Do they have beds? Woke up, found a conical sponge, thought, oh, I've got a good idea, worked this sponge onto her rostrum, and then from that point onwards, female dolphins in this one particular pod continue to do this to that day. So it's an amazing example of one animal using another animal to hunt for a third animal, but only 50% of the animals are actually doing this, and they appear to be passing this on in a teaching, learnt-based way rather than a genetically encoded way passed down. Now, talking about the dolphins introduces another concept in the book that I like talking about, because it's not something that we talk about that much in the sort of public discourse on evolution. And I'm not for a second allowing the idea that evolution by natural selection is not the accurate description of the way life on Earth radiated. It is it's the only game in town as far as understanding biology. But natural selection and sexual selection, which is a sort of subset of natural selection, is the main driving engine behind evolutionary change. But there's also a less talked about aspect to evolution, which is sometimes referred to as drift, genetic drift, but just the notion that some stuff just happens. It happens because of the situation you're in, the environment you're in, but it's not actually driven by selection itself. So many of our human characteristics are not things that we can demonstrate are adaptations. They're just stuff that happened. In the genomic age, we are very good at identifying bits of our genome which have definitely undergone selection. And there's quite a lot of it. Regional adaptation is how we became so global. But so many things that we think of as being, well, we speculate, particularly in branches of evolutionary psychology, we speculate as being part of natural selection and thus can explain contemporary behavior, actually turn out to be just stuff that happened to us. There's a line from one of your presidents, Teddy Roosevelt, which I love, which is this: do what you can with what you have where you are. Now, he wasn't talking about evolution, but it really does encapsulate this key idea about the sort of cosmic happenstance of where a creature evolves. And the reason I bring this up in reference to dolphins is because, well, we know dolphins are smart and they do smart behaviors. They also do plenty of really obnoxious behaviors, particularly sexually, but I'm not going to talk about that. You'll have to buy the book to discover that stuff. But we teach in high school, we teach how the paddles of the front fins of a dolphin, the forelimbs, have exactly equivalent bones to our own hands, right? But they're fused in dolphins because they need those forelimbs to paddle through the sea. So they can't do this. They can't type, they can't play the piano, they can't carve lion men out of tusks because they need their paddles to swim really well. They're not very good at holding things at all, whereas we can hold things very incredibly sophisticated ways enough to be able to, you know, play the violin like King Hua Chung. And so this is a really important point that we sometimes underestimate in terms of trying to understand the evolutionary trajectory of all sorts of organisms. it sounds like a cruel point, but dolphins are never going to evolve the ability to create fire. Because they live in the sea. I was waiting for you to get that, right? That's just never going to happen. Darwin argued that controlled use of fire was absolutely essential to our own evolution. But it changes us, and it's changed lots of organisms, but sea creatures are never going to get to the stage where they could forge steel, which is another significant development in our own evolutionary timeline. That's never going to happen for the dolphins, because they live in the sea. So let's talk about fire, because Darwin thought that we were obligate fire users, which we absolutely are. The benefits of fire are there's tons of them, not just for warmth. It allowed us to migrate to northern climes where it was colder. It also allowed us to cook food. Now, cooking food is absolutely essential to our own development. There's lots of theories that it allowed, particularly cooked meat, allowed us to spend less time chewing, which reduced the musculature in our heads. If you look at gorilla skulls, they have a huge sagittal crest, which is, if you look at a gorilla skull, it has an enormous, like a crown, and it's because the muscles, their jaw muscles, the masseters, connect right up to the top because they spend most of their time chewing chewy leaves. Now, you feel your own temples and clench your jaw. It's the same muscles, but they stop at your temples because we don't spend nearly as much time chewing. One of the reasons for that is because we began to cook our food. And so what is cooked food? It's an external stomach. We begin the digestion process before we put food in our mouth. And that is, we get all sorts of nutrition out of that cooking process, but also we get protection, because if you spend a lot of time with your head in an animal carcass, then you're spending a lot of time eating, which is time that you could be being eaten, right? So if we can minimize the time eating, then that is something which can be selected. So cooking food, absolutely essential. And then there's all the cultural aspects about being around a hearth, being around a fire, and that comes later. Lots of organisms are also fully dependent on fire. We know of the chimpanzees in Fongoli, in Senegal, who have a very sophisticated understanding of the annual savanna fires that come in that area. And they will stand very close, dangerously close, to a fire, which is, of course, mercurial in its behavior. And they will wait until it's gone out, and as soon as it's gone out, seconds later, they will go into a burnt area, and they will fish out burnt, toasted, semi-cooked mammals or lizards that they can eat. Vervet monkeys spend, and marmots as well, in Africa and South Africa, spend less time looking, standing on their back legs and looking into the long distance for fear of predators when the grass is burnt down, and herbivores do that as well. So lots of animals are also dependent on fire and have a complex understanding of fire. But Homo sapiens really has an incredibly obligate, pyrophilic relationship with fire and has done for several hundred thousand years at a minimum. It wasn't just us, though. And I mentioned earlier that only the stone tools remain. Well, there are very few examples of wooden tools that remain, but one was discovered a couple of years ago, discovered in a site in Tuscany in Italy, and it's a set of boxwood clubs. Boxwood is very hard, and due to the nature of the soil that these were discovered in, they were preserved, and they have been preserved for more than 120,000 years. Now, the club itself is interesting as a tool, but also it shows very clearly that the small twigs on the outside of this branch have been deliberately burnt off in order to shape the club. Now, 120,000 years ago in what is now Italy, the only people present were the Neanderthals. So again, Neanderthals had a complex culture and a relationship with fire, which appears to be similar, maybe indistinguishable, from our own. But of course, the Neanderthals are extinct, and so we are the only organism that is capable of starting new fires. Or so we thought until 2017, when the scientific publication of a piece of indigenous experts' knowledge from Aboriginal Australians was published in the scientific literature, but known about by indigenous people of Australia for thousands of years. And it was three species of raptor, three species of birds of prey, who had a very specific behavior, that they have annual savanna fires in Western Australia, as well, and these birds were observed hanging around the edges of these fires, going down and picking up burning or smoldering sticks in their beaks or their talons, and then flying away over natural or man-made fire barriers, dropping them into dry brush, and then they go and sit up in a tree. And they go and sit up in a tree, and as the fire rages, they see the little mammals and the little lizards running away from their fiery death into the mouths of the hungry kites. Now, what an amazing behavior that is. There is a suggestion, I don't know how true it is, but it's an interesting suggestion, that this may be a behavior which humans learn from the birds. And that management of forest fires, of savanna fires in Australia, which the Aboriginal Australians have been doing for thousands of years, may have been learned. We see references to firehawks in some Aboriginal Australian ceremonies, which certainly predate the arrival of Western colonizers in the 17th and 18th century. So we're not the only animal that can start fires. We are the only animal that can start fires from scratch. But I don't know, maybe the birds are working on that too. Okay, so I've touched on a couple of things. I've touched on tools, I've touched on fire as a tool. There's much more content in the book, particularly about things like speech and language. There's a long section on sexual behavior, but it just doesn't feel appropriate talking about it in such an august library, because, well, a lot of it's just absolute filth. But I want to get to the core idea. So cultural transmission is the thing that we do. We're doing it now. Teachers do it every day. In fact, humans do it every time we open our mouths and communicate a unit of information. Every time we speak to another human, we are transmitting a piece of information to someone or a group of people to whom you might not be related. And we radiate out information in every direction with every breath. We have done that for tens of thousands of years. Now, the new bit of this is it's an idea which has really only emerged in the last 5 or 6 years, last decade tops, but it's underrepresented in evolutionary and paleontology, paleoanthropology, for reasons that I think are quite interesting. But it's a very specific area which I think, and I argue in the book, underwrites all of the uniqueness theories that you will no doubt be thinking of. Things like fire use, things like sexual behaviors, things like emotional traits, things like mourning the dead. All of those things that people suggest and think about as being, these are things that we do and other animals don't, or they do differ by degree or by kind, or you know, any of those sort of qualifications. But I think that there is an underlying behavior which underwrites all of the development of those sorts of aspects of cultural transmission. It's referred to as demographic transition, which is not a very sexy way of describing it, but what it is this idea that where we see these sudden explosions in technology and culture and abstraction of thought, musical instruments and art and things like that, they coincide with massive expansions in populations. And we see this all over the world. We see it in Africa, we see it in Europe, we see it in Indonesia. In those spots where we see those examples of behavioral modernity, we also see populations expanding in size. And maybe those populations are expanding in size due to climate changes. We don't, you know, that's part of the theory which is being worked on. But it's also been mathematically modeled. So there's two key areas of research about this. One is Joseph Heinrichsen at Harvard, and the other group is Mark Thomas's group of colleagues of mine at UCL. And they put together mathematical models. We do a lot of mathematical modeling in evolutionary biology, where you plug in tons and tons of data, available archaeological and other data, into a model, and then you try to work out what the best mode of transmission of these types of units of information. A key part of this as well is the correct assumption that humans, unlike every other species, we are a species of experts. So there isn't another species where talents are so unevenly distributed. And of course, you know that's true, because if you want to learn how to do something, what do? You ask someone who knows how to do it. That's why we have mechanics and teachers and librarians. We don't do every job. We tend not to be generalists. But I think that's crucial in the understanding of this idea of how populations expanded, that once one person has an area of expertise, maybe they were super good at carving lion men or carving flutes out of bones, or making tattoos, or cooking, or you know, aspects of hunting. Once one person is capable of doing that, then it benefits the rest of the group by spreading that information as far and as wide as possible. And what the mathematical models say very clearly is that this transmission of information occurs at an optimized rate when a population reaches a certain threshold. When it gets to a particular size, you get just a much better, more efficient way of communicating these units of information in and amongst the groups than you do when the size is reduced. And so that's the working theory. That's the idea that is currently being developed. It's the one that I pin my colors to. There's a good piece of physical evidence which shows the opposite, but is part of reinforcing this similar idea. And it relates to fishing technology. So we've been obligate fishers for fisher people for tens of thousands of years. The earliest known fishing hook is the bottom of a flat shell, one of those conical shells that you see on the beach. And this one I'm showing in the picture here is from Java. It's about 24,000 years old. The actual specimen is still sharp enough to cut your skin. So that's 24,000 years ago. By 10,000 years ago, we have this incredibly sophisticated fishing technology, fine-tooth harpoons that allow us to go out into the ocean and hunt cartilaginous fish in a much more sophisticated fishing technological way. Now, this is a slightly culturally sensitive thing to discuss, but I'll just give you the facts. Part of our evidence for this idea of demographic transition is to do with the relationship between indigenous people of Tasmania and the indigenous people of Australia. Before the end of the last ice age, the last glacial maximum meant that the oceans were significantly lower than they are today, and Tasmania is attached to Australia 11,000 years ago because all the water is sucked up into the glaciers. As the Earth warms, the glaciers melt and the sea levels rise. And about 10 to 11,000 years ago, Tasmania is separated by what we now refer to as the Bass Straits from Australia. Now, the indigenous people of Australia and Tasmania at that time are separated, and we've got no evidence that there was any communication between the island, the two islands, after that separation. But the population size on Tasmania remained very small and isolated compared to the population of the indigenous people of mainland Australia, which continued to flourish. Now, what we know from the archaeological record is that the number of tools on both Tasmania and Australia when they were connected was a few dozen, but by the time European colonizers arrived in the 17th and 18th century, the number of tools on mainland Australia had gone up into the hundreds, as you would expect, and the number of tools in Tasmania had dropped to below 20. And concomitant with that, they had lost a bunch of technologies such as fishing hooks and had returned to being foragers at the seashore and didn't hunt cartilaginous fish. We see the disappearance of cartilaginous fish bones in the archaeological record as you go from 10,000 years ago into the present. And to the extent that some of James Cook's men observed the indigenous people of Tasmania freaking out when they saw them fishing for cartilaginous fish out beyond the reef. And so the idea is it's reinforced by this piece of evidence that, in fact, we think that that small isolated population meant that technological development did not occur in the same way that it did in mainland Australia, where the transfer of ideas was maximized. So this is the key idea. This is the new idea. I think it's right. So I think it's an area of that we will continue to research over the next few years as people get more interested, and as we keep digging, as we keep looking, and we keep finding more genetic evidence. I say it's a new idea because it was first described in 2010, 11, 12, and more recently, a couple of years ago, in the most detailed form. But the truth of the matter is all the best ideas in biology actually do start with Charles Darwin. And in The Descent of Man, just in a passing paragraph, he mentions pretty much exactly this idea. And I'll just read you out this quote, but I'm going to modernize it because he uses Victorian language and manages to, well, ignore 50% of humans in doing so. And the quote from The Descent of Man is this: "As humans advance in civilization and small tribes are united into larger communities, the simplest reason would tell each individual that he or she ought to extend their social instincts and sympathies to all members of the same nation, though personally unknown to him." It's an amazingly prescient phrase, and it says a lot about human behavior today, but also 40,000 years ago, and that is why Darwin is the great genius that he is. I argue, our greatest thinker of all time. But fundamentally, it says that thing, which I think is really important, something to really latch onto, that humankind, if you want a definition, if you want a single thing, which I don't, but if you do, then humans are a species of teachers. Thank you very much. Okie dokie. So I'd love to have your questions, of which I'm sure you have plenty.
So the first Tasmanians were from where? And the population, once it was isolated, were inbred and had no incentive to push out into that sea, the way we've seen the migration out of, what is it, New Guinea, Papua New Guinea, across the Pacific all the way into Hawaii?
Well, we see no evidence of a seafaring culture in Tasmania after it's been isolated. The evidence is not particularly robust. We do, you know, there's plenty of archaeological evidence, but it is all, you know, this is 10,000 years old, so it's quite scant. But what we don't see very large population sizes. It is reasonable to assume that there is therefore isolation and genetic isolation, so a bottleneck, which means an increase in inbreeding, as you suggest. But fundamentally, we don't see evidence of extensive communication with any other humans beyond Tasmania after the last glacial maximum. I don't want to be judgmental about that. It's not indicative of them devolving in any way. It's just that they didn't continue to develop technology as indigenous Tasmanians than the people from which they were separated within the last 10,000 years, which is mainland Australia. So it's a different evolutionary pathway, but it does exemplify this central idea, which is that when we share ideas widely and spread them, that technology progresses and cultural technology progresses as a result.
I'd like to take you back to your mention of phantom species, all right? I don't think this planet is a closed system, and there might be other drivers, like beside time and chance, as far as the evolution process. You may know where I'm going with this. Carl Sagan said it's most probable that we have been visited before by higher intelligences. This has been discussed by a variety of what might be called astroarchaeologists, from Zachariah Sitchin, Eric von Däniken. The assumption is that the genetic code might have been possibly, let us say, altered, and that this might have caused this rapid evolution from ape-like species to Homo sapiens, and the quick arrival of the Sumerians in the early civilizations. And what do they all have in common? They all have in common the mention of gods. And they're not talking about walking trees. Common is invited.
I didn't hear a question there, but it's a great statement. Well, look, I am a huge science fiction fan, and I'm a huge fan of Carl Sagan. He is, you know, close to Darwin as being one of my great inspirations. Ideas about extraterrestrial input to biology on Earth, well, it starts much earlier than that. There's an earlier theory that Fred Hoyle proposed, which is called panspermia, which is that life on Earth was actually seeded from space. I'm not aware of the one you're talking about, but I follow you like a panther on it. The problem with it as an idea is that there's no evidence to support it. The follow-up problem to it is that it's not the parsimonious explanation. We do have really good evidence to support all of the steps that I've talked about. It doesn't mean that there are tons of gaps that still need to be filled. And when I say that there's a mystery human, there is a human that we haven't identified, we have evidence that it did exist, and that evidence is that it was a human and not extraterrestrial. When we talk about the Great Leap Forward or the cognitive revolution, it is sudden in evolutionary timescales, but it's 10,000 years or 20,000 years. So it's not like, you know, the flip of a switch or the click of a finger. There is no Thanos involved. So these very quick switches occur over huge amounts of time. But I think the key thing is that it's not parsimonious. We don't actually require that explanation, because we have really, really solid scientific evidence that does include gaps, but it doesn't include gaps so large that we have to invoke extraterrestrials. As for the existence of religion through cultural history, we also have parsimonious explanations for this, which I do talk about briefly in the book. And it's to do with the psychological behavior, which is known as agency detection, something which does appear to be, you know, very hyper-developed in us, but may exist in other organisms as well, which is just the notion that we need to be able to, if we observe something, rather than just assuming it's dumb nature or the laws of thermodynamics enacting, it's useful if we can attribute the fact that your cousin has been ripped to pieces and is dead next to you, that a cave lion did that rather than I just observing that he doesn't look that good right now. So that's agency detection. But in us, it has become so hyper-developed that we have agency detection all the time for things which are massively don't require agency. That's why haunted houses exist. When tonight, when your house is shrinking as a result of it getting colder, you hear a creaky floorboard and think, holy crap, that was a ghost. Well, it wasn't. It was just a bit of thermodynamics. Now, when we see enough agency detection, it's a useful cultural attribute to say, well, why? What is a better explanation from stuff that we don't understand because we don't have thermodynamics in our lexicon 40,000 years ago? Well, there's something supernatural going on there. One of the things I argue in the book, I'm not a religious person, but I come from a Catholic family. One of the things I say in the book is that if these psychological aspects during our development of behavioral modernity are responsible for the creation of gods, we have also gone down a pathway which has allowed us to tuck them back away again.
Going back to something which is more obvious, while there were populations and civilizations of Indians in North and South America, they did not have much technology before the Europeans arrived. And my own thought, I have no idea if it's based in anything, is that they had no load-bearing animals other than the mammoths that they killed off and the llamas that were used in South America. So therefore, they didn't have any need for a wheel. No one invented a wheel, and there are all these other things they didn't invent either. So that's just something to throw out to you if there's any ideas on why the cultures in this in North and South America did not develop as much.
Well, I think the first thing is that I think that's you may have misrepresented the technology of the indigenous people of the Americas there, who for 20,000 years have been incredibly sophisticated tool users, equivalent to what we see all over the rest of the world. So the current working theories, this is actually in the last book, is that the indigenous people of the Americas migrated from Siberia about 24,000 years ago across what is now the Bering Straits, but then again during the last glacial maximum was just land. We call those people the Beringians. But there's tons and tons of evidence of very sophisticated tool use that starts, I think the earliest is something like 13,000 years, but that is changing rapidly. And next Friday, I'm going to the American Physical Anthropology meeting in Cleveland, where we'll be discussing these things. But I think part of our problem with assessing the differential development of technology sort of relates to that Teddy Roosevelt quote, do what you can with what you've got where you are. The Native Americans, the indigenous people of the Americas, were doing fine until the Europeans came. And we did a really good job of murdering most of them. So the Mexican population, people we refer to as the Incas and the Aztec, had incredibly sophisticated cultures. And a population of tens of millions, I forget the exact number, something like 75 million, within 2 years of Europeans arriving, their population had dwindled down to about 1.5 million. Now, the story of European colonization is the story of decimation of indigenous peoples. And so we hold these ideas about what we as people with European ancestry brought to the rest of the world and make comparisons which are comparisons of superiority. They're saying that we have this technology and you didn't. And it's part of the subjugation of people. It all starts during colonization, European expansion, the age of exploitation and plunder, which coincidentally is the beginning of the first descriptions of scientific racism. And when I say coincidentally, I don't mean coincidentally, I mean because of. This is all content from my next book. but this is, again, what we'll be discussing next week in Ohio, in Cleveland. So I think it's good to think about these things, but it's something we have to think about very carefully, because everyone, whether you're a scientist or not, whether you're a liberal or a conservative, or you know, whatever political or professional aspect you take, we are not immune. None of us is immune to hundreds of years of ingrained prejudices, which many of which we're just not even aware of. I'm not laying that at you, madam. But because these are questions that we need to ask, but the best way to answer them is to look harder at the data and to talk to the people, the indigenous people whose cultures we plundered.
So the meta question is, at what point did the chromosomal number of pairs diverge from other species, and is that important?
What you're alluding to, just for the benefit of the rest of the audience, is that we have 23 pairs, humans have 23 pairs of chromosomes, and the other great apes have 24. So we have one fewer chromosome than gorillas, two as a pair, 48 compared to 46. We can track through evolutionary time by looking at genetic differences, especially macro differences such as chromosome number, which is a huge difference. And we know very well that our chromosome 2, number 2, which is the biggest chromosome, is a fusion of two chromosomes that we see in gorillas today. So we can see this very, very specifically. You might remember we draw chromosomes as they look like sort of pinched socks. Well, we can see the pinch of two different chromosomes. It's now gone, but we can see the remnants of it, like a fossil in the chromosome, which indicates very clearly that at some point in the last 8 million years, two chromosomes in an ancestor of the great apes and us fused, and that became our line, and it didn't fuse, and that became the gorillas, bonobos, chimps, and orangutans. Thank you. Okay, so that's one aspect to it. Now, it becomes an interesting question for two reasons. This is in the book, because we interbred with the Neanderthals, we interbred with the Denisovans. We don't know how many chromosomes they had, because chromosome number is not preserved in the DNA that we get out of the ancient bones. When I say we get the full genome sequence, it's actually just bits of it that we then staple together very, very carefully. So it's not like taking a cheek swab from a living person getting the full 3 billion letters of genetic code. But chromosome number and chromosome breakages are not preserved in that. So we cannot categorically state that Neanderthals had 23 pairs of chromosomes. However, basic biology, high school biology, meiosis and mitosis indicates that you have to have the same number of chromosomes in order for sperm and egg to fertilize and to become the next generation, for conception to happen. So it's not an unreasonable supposition to say that Neanderthals and the Denisovans had 23 pairs of chromosomes. This is quite a technical answer, but it's quite fun too. So I think it is reasonable to say Denisovans and Neanderthals had the same number of chromosomes, the same ploidy as us. However, and this is why biology is always fun and frustrating, because it is a science of exceptions, paper was published 18 months ago, which indicated that equids, so animals like horses, zebras, donkeys, things like that, they have a range of chromosome number between 16 and 31, depending on the species. And those numbers have no bearing on whether they produce fertile offspring or not. And we do not know how that works. When that paper arrived on my desk, I looked at it and I had two simultaneous reactions. The first one is, wow, that's super cool. And the other one is, oh God, no, really? You know, because this is one of the basic fundamentals of biology that I learned for the first time when I was 10. And it turns out, well, it's a bit more complicated than that and we don't really understand it. But that's why we study this stuff. That's why it's called research.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, Information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.